Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2019. This is session number 2601, Tax Cuts in 2018, The Winners, The Losers. My name is Rich Wabakin. I'm Associate Dean at the Leeds School of Business, and I am extremely pleased to be moderating this distinguished panel. I'm going to do some very brief cut-down bios. If you haven't had a chance to look at the bios of these speakers, take a moment to do that. They are an incredibly talented group, and it's really fortunate to have them here with us today. John Havman is an expert in regional economics and local economic development. He's been a senior economist with the President's Council of Economic Advisors and an economist with the Federal Trade Commission. He holds a PhD and master's in economics from the University of Michigan and a bachelor's from the University of Wisconsin. He has recognized the benefits of economic literacy, something near and dear to my heart, in informing national policy discussions. This dedication to outreach by professional economists has developed his vision for the National Economic Education Delegation, NEED, N-E-E-D, a nonprofit of which he is executive director. And he is the proud owner for 4 years of a house in Marin County, and I know I never will be. Also joining us is Robert Kaufman. He is the Robert and Catherine Doxson Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine. He is a political scientist specializing in American foreign policy and national security. He's the author of 4 books, including his most recent, Dangerous Doctrine, How Obama's Grand Strategy Weakened America. He is a former Bradley Scholar and a current adjunct scholar at the Heritage Foundation, received a JD from Georgetown, and his BAMA, Master's in Philosophy, and PhD from Columbia, some unknown school in New York City. He also was our visiting professor of conservative thought last year on the Boulder campus. Dick Scruggs is founder and chairman of Second Chance Mississippi, a charitable foundation assisting young adults striving for work skills and high school equivalency diplomas. His foundation works closely with Mississippi's community college and early childhood learning centers to improve the economic prospects for young adults and their children. He was the lead lawyer for the states in their historic $250 billion settlement with the tobacco industry. For his successes as a lawyer and philanthropist, Scruggs has been profiled by the New York Times, 60 Minutes, and many other media organizations. Little known fact, or maybe it's not little known in Mississippi, he's the brother-in-law of Trent Lott. And you're supposed to say something that isn't in their bio. I'm digging hard here, you know. And Sloan Speck is a member of the law school faculty here at the University of Colorado. His research interests are in tax law and policy, with an emphasis on corporate and international tax, legal and business history, and the ways in which taxation informs and structures the relationship between state and society. He received his LLM in taxation from NYU School of Law, a JD and MA in history from the University of Chicago, and a BA from Rice University. Before law school, Professor Speck taught mathematics at Salesian High School in Richmond, California, where he also coached football. Okay, so with that brief introduction, I would like to start by having the panelists give some brief introductory comments, about 5 minutes each, and I think leading that off is going to be John.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. I am going to start off by just reviewing some of the more significant aspects of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There are two types of cuts. There are those that are temporary and those that are permanent. First, a set that are temporary is the income tax cuts, right, the ones that we all got. They sunset in 2025. Then there's the standard deduction. Right, the standard deduction was roughly doubled for everybody. The personal exemption went completely by the wayside, right? Hence the doubling of the standard deduction. There was a cut in the estate tax. That is to say, the the point at which taxes start being collected was increased from $5.6 million to $11.2 million, right? So another $5.6 million is exempt from the estate tax. There's the SALT tax, the state and local tax deduction, is capped at $10,000. That's an aspect of the law that applies mostly to higher tax states like California, New York, and Florida. And then there's the mortgage interest deduction, which was capped to mortgages of $750,000. On the permanent side, there is the corporate tax cut, which everybody talks about being reduced from 31 to 21%. That's not quite right because it was, in fact, a slightly progressive tax before the 2017 tax law was put in place. And the lowest tax was about 16% on corporations with income less than $50,000. The tax on foreign earnings, in an effort to get companies to repatriate their earnings, was dropped from 35% down to 8% and has resulted in a tremendous repatriation of earnings. There's a 20% pass-through exemption for some sets of partnerships and sole proprietorships, the first 20% of their income exempt from taxation. It also weakened the AMT by raising levels of income, raising the point at which the AMT was effective, and eliminated the Affordable Care mandate, the mandate that we all have insurance. Okay, so there are some just some nuts and bolts, just a reminder for part of what was done. There were many other things that were done in the tax law as well. And now I'll get to at least my answers to the fundamental question posed in the title, who are the winners and who are the losers, right? So in my estimation, there is a clear set of winners, corporations, a clear set of winners. Their average tax rate, I mentioned that the statutory tax rate went down from 31% down to 21%. They have lots of deductions, so the actual tax rate, the effective tax rate on corporations went down from 20% to about 13.2%. I'll argue the second group is moderate to high wealth families, and that's largely because of the estate tax cut. In the short term, all taxpayers get a little bit of something. The lower income taxpayers get much less than high income taxpayers. For the low income taxpayers, the increase in their after-tax income was 0.4%. For those in the top 10%, the increase in their after-tax income was about 4%. And that's the difference between about $50 and $250,000 in benefit. Over the long term, it's only going to be the high income folks that benefit, and that's not because the tax cuts stay in place for them. It's because the high income folks are the ones who are taking in the corporate income. And they're reaping the dividends and whatnot from corporations. But in 2025, again, as I mentioned, the income tax cuts all expire and they go back to their pre-2018 levels. I'll also argue that another set of winners are the anti-taxers, those who are just opposed to taxes. They made out like bandits in this. The losers are very small businesses. Think the corner taco shop. Businesses with less than $50,000 in taxable income, they experienced an increase in their taxes from 16% up to 21%, again, because it used to be a progressive tax. Now it's just a flat tax. Those in high tax states I mentioned, California, New York, Florida, itemizers, right? Because you lose the personal exemption. Now you only get the standard deduction, but that's if you don't itemize anything. If you continue to itemize, you've just lost the personal exemption, which was something on the order of $4,000. Anybody who likes progressivity in the tax structure was a loser because this tax cut clearly benefited the wealthy and the higher income families. And I'll also argue that every other policy issue that the federal government might pursue was a loser, because this tax cut is going to result in approximately $1.9 trillion added to the federal debt. That's only about a 10% increase in the debt, but it's not trivial. And as a result, things like defense and safety net, infrastructure, healthcare, education, research and development, it's going to be much harder to spend more on those. The inclination is going to be to spend less on all of those because of the increase in the debt. And finally, I'll argue that, in fact, all of us are losers from the Job Cuts and Tax Act. And that's primarily because there are other things that we could have done with $1.9 trillion. Right? This tax cut fails pretty miserably when it comes to stimulating economic growth, when it comes to addressing the increasing income inequality that we have, and when it comes to fiscal sustainability. Right? We've just enacted a huge tax cut in a time of recovery. Right? That gives us much less sort of fiscal space to play around with to address the next recession. Right? And there is a recession that will be coming. Right? I'll argue we could have made better investments with $1.9 trillion. If we were going to invest it, and I prefer to talk about government investment rather than government spending, if we were going to invest it, think about every pothole you drive over. Think about infrastructure more generally. Think about health care. Think about education. There are an enormous number of other investments that we could have made rather than just giving people tax cuts. And I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you so much, John, and my other panelists. I want to skip. I'll skip the kind of overview, which John excellently covered, and go right to the winners and losers. And I have kind of three of each. As John mentioned, you know, virtually all Americans are winners, at least in 2018, whether they knew it or not. They got back some of this tax cut through reduced wage withholding throughout the last year. But these tax cuts will have to be paid for at some point, whether that's through tax increases or reduced spending. And either route's going to hurt people in the future. So everyone benefits now, but there's a price to be paid later. In addition, if a lot of the expiring individual tax provisions aren't extended past 2025, this tax law change could be a net tax hike. It will be overall for individuals, and certainly there will be people who really feel some financial pain when these provisions expire. But the real winners, as John mentioned, are the top earners. I'm going to say top 5%, but could be top 20%, could be top 1%. I'm going to say top 5%, especially if they got divorced before January 1st of this year. Change in alimony rules that was material for that category of people. So after tax income for that group, the top 5%, really increases both in terms of absolute dollars and in terms of percentage. Finally, another big group of winners are my people, the tax lawyers, especially early career tax lawyers. You know, if you want to go into the practice of tax, now is the time, just as after 1986, there was a whole generation of tax lawyers who became expert in a new set of rules and developed many clever plans and schemes to help their clients avoid tax. So for young tax attorneys, this is going to be a bonanza, and we should look forward to the machinations they will produce to use all the arcane provisions of this tax law to their clients' good effect. So those are three winners, and I want to talk about three losers as well. My first group, Republicans in the House in New Jersey. There used to be 5 out of 12. Now there's just 1 after the 2018 midterms. And this, I think, reflects some of what John said about the geographic impact of tax reform in 2017. Blue states tended to lose under some of the changes to the individual base provisions. And those states have responded politically in the 2018 midterms. There are other losers as well that are out there. So certain individuals will be really hit hard by things like the elimination of miscellaneous itemized deductions, by the elimination of casualty losses in most cases. And it's going to take some time for that to play out, first to see who the real winners and losers are under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. A second group of losers, anyone who has to read the Internal Revenue Code. These changes, it wasn't a work of literature before, but it really isn't now. These individual tax-based changes, they are layered on top of the existing code. They expire in just a few years, and so we have a running parallel provisions over time. The international tax regime is a significant change, potentially a structural change in the way we think about cross-border taxation. But again, it sits on top of the old rules. The old rules still exist. The complexity is still there. These new provisions, they're difficult reading. They're hard to interpret. There are a lot of voluminous regulations and interpretations dealing with the many ambiguities in the new law, and there's more to come. A final loser is the concept of tax reform. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was pitched politically as being an act of tax reform. But the process was behind closed doors among the partisan leadership of the Republican Party in the House and the Senate. Much of the intellectual groundwork that had been done by people like Dave Camp and Paul Ryan and officials in the Bush 2 administration, that was thrown out in favor of kind of an ad hoc approach that doesn't really seem to have a lot of intellectual coherency. This tax cut is all temporary, so it'll expire relatively soon. This is not 1986 reform. This is hard to really characterize as being reform in a strict sense. And so for future tax legislation, this has lowered the bar for what we call tax reform. It has changed the process. And these implications, I think, are really quite serious for how tax policy unfolds in the future. Thank you.
And we'll move to Dick.
Good afternoon, everyone. Loud enough in the back? One of the beauties of the Conference on World Affairs is they ask people to be on panels like this who know very little about what they're here to talk about. I'm a former trial lawyer. I didn't do any tax work. I paid people to do it, and so those people are some of the winners in this tax code. But I made a lot of money, as I think you heard in the introduction, as a result of the huge tobacco settlement 20 years ago. It's still paying me a lot of money. So as a result of that, I can give you a little personal idea of what it did for me. Now, for the last 6 years, I've been running a nonprofit 501c3 charitable foundation designed to get dropouts, high school dropouts, back into the system and back into the mainstream with either a high school equivalency diploma or a work skills certification of some sort for middle skill training. And so the charitable part of this is fairly sensitive to tax deductibility for donors. But personally, I was a big winner in this recent tax change. I was a top at the risk of sounding like Donald Trump. I was one of the top taxpayers in the country. It was 39.6%. Wasn't that the top rate, John?
Yeah.
It went down to 37%. But the deductibility for state income tax in Mississippi, which is a poor state, we have a 5% state income tax. So I lost the deductibility for that. So income tax-wise, it was about a wash for me. I didn't make out on that as a top earner. But the doubling of the exemption on a state tax will allow me to pass on to my kids and grandkids millions more dollars than I could have a year before the act. So I'm a big winner, not on income tax, but on estate tax. Do I think it's fair? I don't. I didn't have any hand in it. I just sit back and let it rain or let it shine. It's not something I've ever engaged in lobbying for or against. But in terms of fundraising for our charitable foundation, it really hasn't had a big effect that we can tell. We're increasing all the time. For a charity that's only been around for 6 years, every year we're gaining remarkably, and I think the reason for that is remote from tax policy. I think it's because Southerners, for some reason, are more charitable per capita than perhaps other parts of the country, and a lot more people now are paying attention to education in the South, where we lag the rest of the country, especially in a state like Mississippi, which is either 49th or 50th in most categories. But the value of education is becoming more and more important, and while there's a lot of controversy over education, K through 12 and even pre-K, there's not a lot of controversy on workforce training. Both Republicans and Democrats, everyone is in favor of work skills training. And so I think those factors, more than any sort of tax policy, have affected our fundraising more in a positive way than a negative way. So I can only give you anecdotal testimony today about what it's done for me and my foundation, for my family and my foundation. But I'm really interested in what these real experts have to say. Thank you.
And batting cleanup is Robert.
Yeah, and I want to make you feel good. You're not the only non-expert here. Include me in that. I had tax many years ago at Georgetown Law School. Tax 1, Tax 2 with Marty Ginsburg, the husband of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but it's been a long time since then. So I'm not an expert on the technical side of it. I will speak, however, to some more general things that I think potentially make a better case for it, or we have to think of it in a broader context. I think Trump's tax cut, which does have a philosophy to it, is part of an overall strategy, and there are really two competing views of how best to generate economic growth and achieve and sustain prosperity. Do you rely on government spending, government programs? We had 8 years of that under Obama, where we also had the weakest recovery from a recession in history. Or do you rely on the marketplace? And I think Trump's tax policies and the way it was structured reflects a view, right or wrong, and it's not atypical. It was also Ronald Reagan's, that leaving money in the hands of the taxpayer was a better way of generating economic growth. I know we're going to have a debate about this, and I know President Obama, who proves the adage, if the meek and the modest inherit the earth, he'll be entitled to a tiny apartment. President Obama has claimed credit for this recovery since President Trump, which honestly I think is the equivalent of Neville Chamberlain claiming credit for D-Day. If you look at how the economy is performing since Trump and since the return of capital, which began the day Trump was elected in anticipation of a more favorable market for entrepreneurship, our economy is doing very well comparatively. According to Gordon Chang, who is the best of the Chinese economists, who is an outlier but tells us what we need to know, we're actually using the key variable of energy consumption growing at a faster rate, according to Gordon, than China. African-American unemployment is a historic low. Hispanic employment is at a historic low. And I think there's a case to be made that this type of tax policy, integrated with this broader philosophy, including deregulation, has stimulated the economy in a way that the alternative approach has not. Let me also talk about two or three other specific features that I think overall are good things, even though, for those of you who expect or that I'm representing my own interests and I'm a tribune of the rich, I'm a professor. Plus, I live in California. I was a loser in this tax reform plan, but I deserve to be. One of the best features about this plan is the cap on deductibility of state and local taxes. And the reason is high-spending, profligate states like California were masking the degree to which taxpayers were paying and suffering a burden and passing that burden on to other states and often less affluent taxpayers. I think it is a good thing for political accountability that the states, the blue states or states that spend money, bear the political consequences and the accountability to their voters. One. And two, as someone who is, to say the least, deeply skeptical of the Obamacare's long-term sustainability and desirability, I think that eliminating the mandate will make it clear that Obamacare is untenable sooner rather than later. And I think that's also a good thing for the country. I commend my experts for a mastery of the technical aspects of the tax plan that I don't have, and they do.
So we'd like to encourage questions from the audience, and in this Conference on World Affairs session, we utilize both the app that you may be familiar with and a no-card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a no-card, as some of you have already done, and pencil from one of the producers. You must write legibly, please. If you are a student, please note this in your question, and please make your questions brief and to the point. So before we get to the questions, I want to know if anybody who would like to respond to any of the comments they heard. And John's nodding at me, so I think John would like to respond. So, John, take it away.
I would. Thank you, Richard. First, I want to correct an error from earlier. I failed to thank CWA for inviting me to be here. It's been a great pleasure. I'm looking forward to the rest of the conference. Now that that's taken care of, a couple of things, Bob.
Me? I'm surprised.
No, Bob and I are going to have some fun up here today. So Bob expressed, I think, a personal preference for stimulating the economy through tax cuts to the rich.
Well, it's not just a permanent, a personal preference. It's a different philosophy, and it's not just the rich. It's whether private incentive rather than government spending is the best way to generate wealth and freedom.
Right. So it reminds me of one of Bill Maher's new spots. If anybody watches Bill Maher, it's entitled, I Don't Know It for a Fact, I Just Know It's True. And if you test that hypothesis with almost every economic study that tries to address it, it finds that trickle-down economics, which that is, just doesn't work. There's no evidence that having reduced tax rates for the wealthy will stimulate growth of the economy more than reducing tax rates for the poor. And in fact, reducing tax rates or giving more money to the poor will stimulate growth because they will spend all of it. Giving tax cuts to the wealthy, it's not guaranteed that they will spend it in the United States, that they will invest it in the United States. A lot of it may go abroad. So that's one point. The second point has to do with the salt tax. I mean, if it is such a reward to states who spend too much, why not just eliminate it altogether? Why cap it? Why not say all you states, you know, you're responsible for your own spending?
Well, politics is the art of reconciling the desirable and the possible, so you can't do it. And as, in all due respect, your claim that all economists have concluded, as you did, about tax cuts, please. There are many economists at the Hoover Institute, University of Chicago, Reagan people, that will tell you exactly the opposite. Now, I'm not going to...
Bob, they will tell you the opposite, but it's not borne out by economic analysis.
Well, I would like to have them go toe-to-toe with you, because you're claiming something that's authoritative than in the field of economics, to say the least, is contestable. How do you explain the growth rates of Reagan in the 1980s in spite of his tax policies?
Because Reagan spent like a crazy man.
And that's why we did it. We spent crazy in the 1970s, right. And all we got was stagflation rather than prosperity.
We did not spend like crazy in the 70s the way that we did in the 80s. The increase in defense spending, that's clearly stimulatory. But we're going to disagree on that.
We certainly are.
All right. So finally, you're skeptical of the ACA and its long-term sustainability. I'll argue that it will end up being completely unsustainable because we're suddenly taking away everything that's designed to make it sustainable. Without the mandate, it's clearly unsustainable. I think every healthcare expert will tell you that. So, if you think bring about its downfall sooner.
Well, since we agree on that, and if you're on the side that thought it was a bad idea in the first place, that's a lot of the country, that means that as far as winners, those of us who believe this was a bad idea in the first place count us as winners because this is going to expedite, as you say, the reckoning for Obamacare, which I think was going to come anyway, but it's going to happen sooner rather than later to the country's benefit.
Let me clear the record. I was not saying that I thought that Obamacare was unsustainable. I think it's unsustainable.
Without the mandate.
I think it's unsustainable.
Without the mandate.
Well, sure. That's why the mandate was in there.
Let me jump in here. Bob, isn't Obamacare the spawn of Romneycare, a Republican idea?
It exactly was.
I mean, it was great when it was done in Massachusetts. It worked. And all of a sudden, because it was, bore Obama's name.
Hold on. Romneycare was controversial when Romney ran for president precisely on that point. Now, you may support Romneycare or Obamacare, but the idea that something like Obamacare was uncontestably supported in the Republican Party and that wasn't a liability for Romney simply isn't so.
Well, I do think that there are conservative organizations that suggested that Romney's plan was a good one and endorsed it.
Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation, who has crossed the aisle and discovered liberalism and is now at Brookings, is the one person at Heritage who did that. But honestly, whether you agree with it or not, most conservatives did not think it was an asset that Romney had this record of the Romney Care in Massachusetts, which I'm from there, has a much different set of conditions that made it more tenable, if not desirable there, where my sister's a physician, than any place else.
So I'd like to just reorient back towards the tax cut. I don't know anything about this Obamacare thing. Taxes is more my area. But I do actually want to talk about kind of the ad hoc nature and the idea of a philosophy behind the tax cut. And there are two aspects to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that I think are salient in this respect. One is that it enacted expansive expensing for capital investments. So if you make a capital investment as a business, you can deduct the full cost right now today and get a tax benefit equal to today's tax rate. So back when it was 35%, that would be 35 cents on the dollar you get back for making a capital investment. With the rate cut, it's now 21 cents on the dollar. So there is a kind of a tension between expensing, which was one provision of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and the corporate rate cut and the pass-through deduction, which is another aspect of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And for me, it's hard to reconcile why you would do both. They're both incredibly costly. It seems like one or the other should be sufficient to get the kind of juice you need in the economy. So I do think that there's a lot of internal tension to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that does not show a very clear philosophy or a clear idea of how the tax system ought to work. There are a lot of one-off kind of giveaways or incentive programs that sometimes don't work well together. So I do think that's something that is worth keeping in mind.
I agree with you, but here I do have expertise, and you're talking analytically about a tax plan that has an integrated philosophy. I'm going to respond that politics is the art of reconciling the desirable and the possible, and ground this in the mathematics that Trump had. Trump had a very slender majority in the Senate, only 52, including four or five outliers, as the healthcare debate indicated. So I would respond to you that even stipulating you're right, Trump's tax plan was going to have more anomalies and contradictions by the very nature of the political process he needed to put together a winning coalition than a tax plan where you had a significant majority in both houses of Congress. And then my rebuttal to you also is stipulating your legitimate criticisms about the contradictions. Would you argue with the point that this reflected overall a philosophy that individual initiative and private endeavor was a better way to generate wealth than government spending? Was it consistent, at least in being true to that philosophical premise?
I mean, maybe. I don't know if that's Trump's philosophical grounding. I don't know if he really has that much of a principle that's driving what he does.
Well, I'm writing a book about it. I think he does.
That it's the tax reform effort in 2017 was not as coherent as the camp effort in 2014 or the Ryan plan over the summer in 2017. What we ended up getting was very much kind of taped together with cobbled together from a variety of disparate ideas. Yeah,
but fair enough. But the Ryan plan that could get through the House with those majorities could not have gotten through the Senate with Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, and John McCain in 2017. So stipulating Ryan had a more coherent plan, I think you're underestimating the political variables that also affected the outcome, reconciling the desirable with what Trump thought he needed to do to get it through, which he barely did, even making those provisions that seem to be anomalies.
So I'm going to jump in with moderator's prerogative here because we have a lot of questions coming in and we have about 25 minutes left in this session. So my first question comes from a student who asks, other than tax cuts, how can we stimulate the economy and produce evidence of equitable and sustainable growth?
Oh, how else we could have stimulated the economy? We could have done exactly an inverse tax cut to what we did. Right? We could have had the tax cut benefit lower incomes to a much greater extent than it did upper incomes. That would have led to more growth, I'll argue, because the job creators are not the wealthy. The job creators are the people who spend the money. Right? People don't invest money unless there's demand for it. And you grow the economy largely by stimulating consumption, by stimulating demand. That's how you grow the economy. By giving people a whole bunch of money and saying, here, you go and invest it, that's not going to be as effective at stimulating the economy. That will stimulate the economy more and, I would argue, lead to much more equitable growth.
Does anybody else want to comment on that?
Sure, I'll jump in. There are two ways of thinking about the tax system. One is that it's a tool for doing stuff, and the other is that it's a tool for raising revenue. And you could even kind of parse those functions and separate them from each other. I think my general approach would be to let the tax system raise its revenue and then be very transparent and very clear about what the economic incentives are going to be that our government will use. Some could be spending, some could be tax incentives. You could use a variety of different tools to accomplish things, and you should evaluate each tool based on how effective it is. And I want to give an example from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of something that was not terribly effective. So the international tax changes, the corporate tax rate cuts, those were intended to stimulate capital investment by large businesses, by multinationals. And what really I think happened, and I think there's broad consensus as to what occurred, is that in 2018 there was a big spike in stock buybacks. So that cash was not going into, you know, facilities and equipment and plants and workers' salaries. It was instead going to repurchase shares from generally the public and line those shareholders' pockets with cash. And those shareholders may have bought more stock and made more investments, and they may be the right people to make those investments. But that was not the narrative coming out of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when it was enacted. The idea was that these businesses would reinvest this capital into the economy, and that just didn't happen. It went to shareholders.
The top three uses for repatriated funds were paying down debt, stock buybacks, and mergers and acquisitions. You know, new investment was number four.
then what do you think accounts for the rather robust economy since 2017 and the weakest recovery in the history of a recession prior to that, even though it seems that all the policies that you've advocated as an alternative are what we tried the previous 8 years prior to Trump becoming the president?
Bob, what was GDP growth in the fourth quarter of 2018?
What was the overall GDP growth of the Obama administration? On average, 1.8%? Going over 3% now?
No, we're not growing over 3%. We grew over 3% for two quarters. We had also a big stimulus in the first quarter of 2018 with a big spending bill that was passed. It's very difficult to argue that those two quarters were a result of the tax law. Right? We had a sugar high from the spending and some repatriation. We had 0.6 of the 4.2% growth in the second quarter was because of soybean exports to China. Right? So you can't include that as part of the tax law.
So
we had two quarters of 3%+.
So African-American employment is not at a record low?
I'm not going to argue about African-American employment. We're talking
Hispanic.
About growth.
State of the economy, growing jobs. This seems to be much healthier since 2017. What you're saying is that this is miraculously having nothing to do with Trump, even though the policies that you've advocated as an alternative had an eight-year track record that yielded a less robust economy than we have now.
Well, I disagree that Obama was actually allowed to implement his policies. Are you saying that the Tax Cuts and Job Act was designed to reduce African American unemployment?
No, the tax. Yes, in a sense, it was designed to stimulate the economy and let the United States grow and have a robust economy again. In contrast to the previous 8 years and the European Union's sclerotic growth, which is in many cases attributable to the very type of policies that you advocate, spending too much, taxing too high, too few people are spending for too many's benefits, and Trump decided in his tax policies an aspect of that to reverse that, and I think so far the preliminary record's pretty good, and we'll have a test of that in 2020, and since we're in California, here's a bet. In Marin County, you'll take me to lunch there, and
I'll take
you to lunch in Malibu if I lose.
Well, look, let me weigh in here just a minute on the lower unemployment rates in the country. Remember, that's only people who are actively looking for a job.
Thank you.
The labor force participation rate is, to me, far more important than the unemployment rate. In my state, which is 38% African American, the labor force participation rate is barely 50%. That is, barely 50% of the adults in my state either have a job or are even looking for a job. The only state worse than us is a largely white state, is West Virginia, where fewer than half the adults in that state have a job or are looking for work. But the lower unemployment rate for African Americans is not indicative of their boat rising with the tide. It's not. In poor states, the labor force participation rate has barely moved. And in the country, it's moved up a tick or two, I think.
A tick or two.
But it's still at 62, 63%.
It's down about 6 points since before the Great Recession.
Yeah, okay. So labor force participation rate are people who are actively, who have a job. And so the unemployment rate just means that there are fewer people looking for work.
But that was also true in the Obama years as well.
Yeah, it was. But you hadn't forgotten what happened in 2007, 2008, have you?
Talking about 2009.
And you're referring to what?
So I'd like to move on to another question.
Stock market is 6,500, wasn't it?
There are several,
what is it now?
Both electronic and paper questions related to the impact of eliminating the itemized deductions and the impact it's going to have on charitable contributions. Or do we know what kind of impact it's going to have? And I don't know if Sloan, if you have any thoughts on that or other people on the panel.
Sure, I'm happy to weigh in.
I think there's not a clear picture right now. What I've been reading from both people who are on the fundraising side and people who are on the tax side and the high net worth advising side has been really mixed. So some people say that contributions are down, some people say they're up. It seems to be kind of a wash overall. It'll be really hard to know what the longer term effects are until we have a couple of cycles of annual giving. One thing that is clear is that there is now a strong incentive to do things like bunching your giving. So you don't give for a few years, then give a whole bunch all at once. So you get back in that itemized deduction world that's been curtailed by the larger standard deduction. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe big gifts have more social impact. So we want people to save their dollars and give all at once in a big amount. It may be that charities actually need small donations kind of run rate, and those may dry up after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And that could be really bad for charities. A final factor that I think is important to mention is that this kind of lumpy giving is going to have a big effect on what are known as donor-advised funds. And these are essentially accounts that are charities, but you can think of them like kind of brokerage accounts, like Fidelity has one, Vanguard has one. These allow large one-time donations to be made to a charity that will essentially invest the money for you and let you direct smaller gifts out over time. So we should expect, I think, a big jump in donor-advised funds. That would allow you to transform the kind of bunching idea into run rate donations. The problem is those funds are actually quite expensive. They charge fees, and that they enrich the employees at Vanguard and the owners of Fidelity. They're not really necessarily entirely appropriate for kind of mid-level donors. So I think we'll see a change in the donor landscape, and we can kind of predict what that change might look like. Whether it causes a dramatic reduction in charitable giving, I think it's too early to tell.
I think that's right.
I want to say the charity we run, it's not hurt us, at least not visibly. I think our donations have been on the rise steadily. I don't know if they would have risen more or less without the change in tax law, but it hasn't adversely affected us.
So I have another student question. This is one that I'm sure will be of interest. What is the potential for shifting from an income tax to a wealth tax? What are the pros and cons of such a movement?
No one yet. Everyone as well, if you'd like. So, I mean, income tax is a wealth tax, right? So an income tax, your income is your consumption throughout the year, and any changes in your net worth, any changes in your wealth. So income taxes do tax a component of wealth, changes in wealth. That's a very hard thing to do in a way that's not leaky, that's not subject to tax gaming, and that's kind of fair and effective. The current kind of spate of wealth tax proposals, there are a number of issues, both legal and kind of economic. But one thing to kind of think about is, it might be advantageous to us to separate out our wealth taxation and our consumption taxation. You could have a consumption tax on one hand, and then a wealth tax that would reach the other component of income that we currently tax. So I think there are many good arguments in favor of kind of switching out tax systems or having different combinations of tax systems. It'd be worth trying some of them if there's the political will to do so.
Yeah, and I agree with that completely. As for switching from income to wealth, it's never going to happen and probably not a good idea. Augmenting, since we have an economy that's getting increasingly good at generating wealth and less good at generating income, it seems that augmenting the income tax system that we have with the wealth tax is not an unreasonable thing to do.
Thank you. There is another set of questions, multiple questions related to economic or qualified opportunity zones. This is a big issue in Boulder, where we do have, in fact, opportunity zones, and it's being debated. And I know it's one all over when I travel the state that comes up frequently. So can you discuss the impact to date? I realize you don't have data regarding these opportunity zones.
how it relates to low-income housing, credit, affordable housing projects, and general developments. What do we know so far?
Do you know anything about the local opportunity?
So I don't know a whole lot. It's a really technical area, and it's new. I have a number of colleagues who have done some interesting work in it, but I'm not an expert myself. But my understanding is that actually putting the deals together is quite difficult, and some of it, it's a relatively new provision, so it just takes time to get these deals put together, to get the capital lined up, to get the credits going to the right spot. And it takes guidance from Treasury to kind of be certain that you've got the right structure for these types of things. So there are a lot of people who are really excited about qualified opportunity zones, and there are a lot of people who have been severely disappointed when they realize that the project that was near and dear to their hearts is going to miss on that tax benefit because of timing or structuring or some other variable. So I think it's been hard to put the deals together, is my understanding at this point.
Regarding economic benefits, I know absolutely nothing about what's going on locally. But research on these types of arrangements more generally has shown that there's more diversion of economic activity than there is generation of economic activity. Now, perhaps if you're moving it from well-to-do places to less well-to-do places, there's cause for that. But they haven't been shown to be overall, net economy growers.
So there are also several questions around the estate tax. Some are more worded more harshly than others, but the question is fundamentally who benefits, who wins and who loses specifically from the estate tax provision?
Anybody with an estate bigger than $5.6 million. They benefit from the provision. Who loses? The fisc. We get increased debt. I think that's roughly it.
So there's a feature of the income tax that actually kind of works in conjunction with the estate tax. So when someone passes away, all of the potential income, the potential gain in their assets disappears, is forgiven permanently. So we talked about taxing wealth. So if you're a wealthy person who passes away with a lot of stock holdings from 1972 or something like that, when the market was really down, they've really gone up. All of that potential gain is forgiven when that person passes away on the income tax side. And it should be picked up on the estate tax side. You really shouldn't be able to have it both ways. So by increasing the estate tax exemption, it makes this this step up in basis on death, as it's known, a much more valuable loophole for people to exploit. So I do think that you have to either address the loophole on the income tax side, or you have to have a robust estate tax that closes down some of the incentives to hold assets until you die.
Yeah, on that provision, that the original Trump plan was exactly as you said. It would predicate the estate tax on not getting the stepped up basis, and that's something that got lost in the bargaining and the log rolling to the end.
When the Bush administration eliminated the estate tax for a year, that was part of it. Everyone knows about this problem, the political will just isn't there.
That's a political will issue rather than a coherence issue.
John, I think the personal exemption went up to doubled from 5.6 to 11.2.
Oh, right. That's why I said anybody with an estate bigger than 5.6.
Okay.
So the 5.6, between 5.6 and 11.2 is no longer.
Yeah, you're a beneficiary.
Right, okay, good. Yeah.
Another thing to add, what's often brought into this conversation is, well, what about small businesses and small farms, right? Is it really fair to tax, you're going to take away the business, you're going to take away the farm if they have to pay the estate tax? Well, with the limit even at 5.6, we're no longer talking about affecting small businesses and small farms, right? They're all smaller than 5.6 million. So we can eliminate that aspect of the conversation.
Well, to be fair, I think the estate tax in its heyday only contributed a small tenth of 1% to the federal revenue. It's a very, very small part of
I think it's up about 1.5%.
Okay. But it's not a big mover of the needle in terms of federal revenue.
No, but reducing it at this point in time, where wealth is getting even more heavily concentrated amongst a small number of people, probably not a good policy maneuver.
So there are a number of questions, and including a student question related to trickle-down economics, which we've all heard before. But the student asks, if the wealthy are spending all of their tax cut, isn't that indicative that trickle-down economics works? So I don't know that they're...
Well, I'll challenge the premise. The wealthy are not spending all of their tax cut. I mean, which of the wealthy, the top 0.1%, got an extra a windfall of $250,000 because of the tax cuts? Top 0.1%, $250,000 for each family. And the notion that they're going to go out and spend another $250,000 is incredible on its face.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the spenders, a lot of the spenders in the economy are in the middle class, and that's when you talk about stimulating, spending. That's I think where one ought to look. And just the facts are that this round of tax cuts, it helped the middle class some, but not as much as it helped the very top earners. And so you're going to get less increase in consumption by doing that.
All right, we're down to the last 4 minutes, so we'll save this question one point each. The question is, how would you change the tax code to increase growth and investment, specifically the tax code, not other types of projects, given what is in place right now? No one's going to comment.
I'd reduce the capital gains tax. I'd eliminate the estate tax, and I reduce corporate tax rates, and try to move to a graduated flat tax system.
Bob's going to force me to ask him, why give so much preference to capital and so little to labor? But that's not the question posed to me, so I won't.
Because when you give capital, you benefit labor. That's why.
That's trickle-down economics.
I don't call it that, and that's called Reagan in the 80s versus Carter in the 70s and Obama in the terrible years between 2008 and 2016.
I can call it a catfish. It's the same thing. So what I would do is...
We'll let the voters decide that.
All right. Well,
I'm looking forward to dinner, and I'm going to run up your bill.
I will happily pay it. So what I would do is what I suggested earlier. I mean, inverse the cuts. The bottom people in the bottom 40% got an average of $400 in terms of tax cut from this. The top 0.1% again got $250,000. If you give more money to people in the bottom 40%, they're going to do exactly one thing with it. They're going to spend it. Consumption is 70% of the U.S. economy. Consumption is what drives the economy, not investment.
Comments at the end?
Sure. So in terms of increasing growth and investment, a serious problem in our tax system for decades at this point has been how we tax cross-border investment, both into the U.S., now from U.S. companies to foreign countries. And the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was an effort to reform some of that system. And from my perspective, it really made things more complicated and more difficult and didn't solve a lot of the underlying problems that we're currently facing in a global economy. So I think if we were to make a change to the tax law that would kind of put business into a good position, it would be to reform, have real, concrete, durable, well-thought-out international tax reform. That's the task I think we face in the next 5 or 10 years.
If I'm going to weigh in on this a little bit, one of the things my state did right, one of the few, is that it created a tax credit against state income tax for donations to early learning collaborative associations in the state. That is programs for four-year-olds, pre-K, kindergarten programs. which have shown great results in those kids now passing at much higher rates the third grade reading gate and moving on. And that was this has been stimulated primarily by tax credits to people like me who donate money to these early learning collaboratives and other worthwhile educational organizations in lieu of paying state income tax. So I'd like to see that on a broader scale. I'd like to see more tax credit available for investments in education.
And with that, please join me in thanking our panel.